Imagine the sound of your grade school slideshow right now. You know, that plucky narrator describing your friend the atom, and the clicking when the frames change, that momentary black, then shocking white of the projector beam while things segued. Your magnificent brain just made it all possible. Your brain is actually the end of your spinal cord, perched up there on your neck, like the finial on a flagpole, like the knob on a picket fence, like the head of a clothespin, secure in its shell of bone. It's an endless comptroller of thought and sensation from birth to dearth, though some would claim that the brain, like the soul, is dispersed throughout the body, others saying that the sensation that lets the decapitated chicken keep running is mere synapses. But enough instruction. Let Sarah Bellum speak for herself. Today, the Mind's Eye Radio Collective brings you Me and My Noodle, or The Brain Train. Guy Thorvaldsen seems to believe that the old gray matter needs to be taken out for a run now and again. He's not afraid to open the bonnet and watch the workings.
Defining the brain is a slippery enterprise. Yes, we know what it looks like, thanks to the plethora of CSI shows. Busty autopsists lifting that gelatinous, half-football-shaped lump of gray worms from a poor victim's skull, examining it for clues. We also know that when the brain dies, the rest of us turns from animal to vegetable, unworthy of life. And we know the left side of the brain runs the business, while the right side runs the creative show. But then we get to the trickier subject, how the brain does what it does the most. Think. Even trying to imagine how the brain thinks is a redundancy, a mental cul-de-sac, imagining thinking. While other organs appear to do things by rote, suck air in and out, clean alcohol-tainted blood, transfer urine, stand at attention when called to action, the brain creates thoughts, lots of them. But just try to describe what a thought is. Except for the balloon bubbles in graphic novels, we can't see thoughts. Thoughts are not really a sound, although sound carries thoughts. But just try seeing a word come out of someone's mouth. Or imagine that string of letters entering your head. Thoughts tend towards the more ethereal, atmospheric, gaseous, perhaps celestial. Now imagine, where did that last thought come from? Yes, I know that brilliant scientists have conjured up chemical or psychological definitions of thoughts, but do they really know what a thought is? It's a guess at best, like gazing up into the heavens and asking ourselves, what is the universe actually in? But perhaps the heavens is as good a metaphor as any for opining about thinking. Imagining thoughts like stars randomly arising from within the deepening blackness of dusk. But here's the catch. Once night has fallen, the pattern of stars are mostly predictable. Night after night, the constellations tell the same story. Thinking is much less predictable. Try writing an essay, throwing it away, then write the exact essay again, word for word. Not a chance. Perhaps conjuring thoughts is more like a call and response, a whisper sent off into a pure, dark summer night, and the response, beyond answering, what does 2 + 2 equal, is as arbitrary as trying to guess where and when any of the 6,000 fireflies in your backyard will decide to light up. But that's only the beginning. Once lit up, we are challenged to arrange those fireflies of thought into new thoughts and sentences and ideas. Then other times it seems the thinking process is more immediate. We eliminate the first step of calling forth ideas, and instead complete ideas race at us like a meteor shower, while we frantically dance around in our noggin trying to formulate them into logic, or a poem, or an essay about the brain. This brings up another aspect of thoughts, memories. They appear like birds, or cars, or elephants charging out of the mist, so much so that the researchers sometimes develop drugs to stop them. But what is the price of controlling the linguistic affluence of our brains? The same, I imagine, as trying to control the universe. Then there are those blissful times when the fireflies of illumination flow more gently into our awareness, sweetly, like good sex, effortlessly, with a breathtaking sense of command and relevance, similar to the endomorphic rush of long-distance runners when they've hit their stride. Elegant thoughts arriving in beautifully structured light bulbs hovering over our heads. Yes, a lovely thought, we think, but still, to define it? My girlfriend says that meditation is a way to slow down this whole thinking thought process, to allow us to step aside and observe this cacophonic flow of ideas without responding to them with yet more thoughts. But of course, even quiet observation of thinking requires the brain to notice and locate things. Uh-oh, there goes my laundry list of complaints about my boyfriend, and then we're suddenly thinking about our last boyfriend, or sex, or whether our current hairstyle is retro or postmodern. Soon we're yelling, stop, stop, right in the middle of our peaceful meditation. And the sensei whacks us on the shoulder with his bamboo cane and suggests maybe we aren't ready for enlightenment this time around. I know my thoughts on the brain are primitive, and that even as we contemplate this conundrum, billions of research dollars are being spent to discover what actually goes on in that twisted mass of linguinied veins and cartilage. Perhaps someday the secret will be revealed, the biochemical equation unraveled that computes how a thought or an idea or words are formed. But even on that day, I will still have this question. If the thought comes from a bunch of biochemical reaction, just who kickstarts the thought into action? Who is running the show? In the end, thinking about what the brain does, thinking, reasoning, lusting, playing, interpreting, composing, is a thing trying to imagine itself. A practice not unlike something wise teachers and good friends tell us we'd all benefit from, seeing ourselves from outside ourselves, especially through the eyes of our beloved. They tell us if we could just do this, we'd be happy, or at least think we are. But then those same teachers would also tell us the thing we seek is not the thing at all. And so, if you think you recognize a thought in the road, kill it before you delude yourself that you truly know something. This is Guy Thorvaldsen from Mind's Eye Radio.
Lynn Patrick Smith worries about something slipping away in I Think It Happens While I'm Sleeping.
Discreetly, my brain cells are depleting themselves. Not frantically, like shock therapy. They haven't scattered like a flock of scared sparrows or been asked to leave like unruly teenage children. I really did want them to stay. Some seem to have simply dozed off in front of some brainwave TV, leaving so unexpectedly they failed to have their affairs in order. Others chose silent suicides, swallowing that little secret agent pill, afraid they'd crack under pressure and their secrets, if revealed, might prove fatal. Some vanished like relatives I lost track of. They might show up someday, slapping me on the back with stories of the past that will clash so with my memories, I'll find it hard to imagine I actually shared a past with them. Anyway, they will be such loud, rude house guests. I'll wish they would just leave for good. Fortunately, I do have a reserve of brain cells to rely on, although lately some of them have become suspect. They ignore or only vaguely remember me, like I'm someone they sat behind in study hall years ago. Now they can't remember my name. I swear I faintly hear a group of them planning their escape, repeating, "Wait till he's asleep. Just wait till he's asleep." This is Lynn Patrick Smith for Mind's Eye Radio.
In these two poems, Ruth Nichols knows the brain for better and sweeter and bitter and meaner in On Chocolate and My Sister's Brain.
On Chocolate. This is your brain on chocolate. Not a pretty sight. So smeary and melting like Salvador Dali's watch. Come on, get with the program. Production, production, ignore the bending time. The Dali watch runs on chocolate, runs chocolate down the Dali edge of the table. Your brain is running on chocolate, your body melting on a couch like a Dali plucked chicken. Turn on the program. This is your brain on chocolate. My sister's brain. I wanted to write about her brain. That was the focus. Pressure from the tumor, an unusual forgetfulness. Surgeons carved, radiation left ashes to settle in the hollows. But the tumor husk opens, lets loose its seed. Cancer flows down the spine, lodges in the liver, inhabits her left breast. So this isn't about her brain. It's about her goodbye. And me, wishing I could read her to sleep. This is Ruth Nichols for Mind's Eye Radio.
Every good hurler knows you don't send the same pitch across the plate time after time. Fran Rawl switches it up for us in Snoozy Tuesday.
Snoozy Tuesday. What's going on up here in my brain? Such thin tendrils, coil and uncoil, octopus-like, reaching out from some unknown center for some unknown reason. I gaze around slackly, mystified by this thick veil, wading through layers of silence, touching no live wires. No emergency flashes fight this oozing nappness. The energy is not there to switch gears, and I drift like flotsam and jetsam, catching briefly on awakeness. But I doze deeper and deeper, keep coming up for air, slower and slower, fronds of light slowly waving. Tiny Z's hover like sweat bees, and I'm down for the count without even being fertilized. This is Fran Rawl waking up for Mind's Eye Radio.
Thank you.
all think we know things and recently have been given confidence that even if we don't know things the way others do, we all have some kinds of intelligences. Esther Cameron explores our received wisdom on the subject of the cognitive organ.
Long, long ago, when I was a high school student, educators liked to describe intelligence as a single number, your IQ. Since then, word has gotten around that this is like stating the price of something without mentioning what it is. These days, we hear about multiple intelligences, linguistic, social, mathematical, etc. Yet even 7 or 9 types of intelligence do not quite capture the downright quirkiness with which abilities are distributed and assembled in any given individual. I haven't as yet heard of people being encouraged to take inventory of their own abilities and then compare notes. It's hard to be objective about oneself, but who else knows your mind from inside? Pace off its length and breadth. Take it in your hand and admire its coruscating facets. As a sample, here's a start at my own inventory. It's always been clear that most of my intelligence is linguistic. I said my first word at 6 months, wrote my first poem at 6 years, at various times have spoken 5 languages fluently and have written poetry in 3 of them. I've also written literary criticism, memoirs, essays, a few parables, only not realistic fiction, for which I have no talent at all. I can't think of a plot or get a character across a room. This gap may be related to weak spots in the math, science, logic, mechanical, spatial area. Long division and algebra made me cry. In chess, I can't think 2 moves ahead. Certain types of reasoning, as in any text on economics or any explanation of how computers work, rapidly turn a corner and leave me standing there looking this way and that. I have little sense of direction. I am also not musical in the sense of being able to read scores, sight read, follow the development of a fugue, and so on. So you would not expect that I would be able to write through composed melodies for some of my own and others' poems, yet this I've managed to do. Perhaps a scrap of tune-making ability is part of the bard's toolkit. You would also expect that I wouldn't be able to handle poetic forms that depend on numerical relationships and have complicated mechanical requirements. Wrong again. You wouldn't expect any of my poems to have a map-like quality, or that I'd have been able to map a set of ideas onto an imaginary building, as I have. Perhaps that is related to the one mathematical subject I enjoyed in school, plain geometry. 2 other formal poets that I know of, Edna St. Vincent Millay and Richard Moore, have written about plain geometry. Besides mathematics and chess, I am weak in athletics and, alas, social skills. Apparently, I am not the only poet to be taxed with social disabilities. See Baudelaire's Albatross. Exiled on the ground amid jeers, his giant wings prevent him from walking. Or, as Robert Burns put it in To a Daisy, such is the fate of simple bard, on life's rough ocean luckless starred, unskillful he to note the card of prudent lore, till billows rage and gales blow hard, and whelm him o'er. Some years ago, I worked as office manager for a group of social workers. For the office party, we were supposed to bring in a photograph of ourselves as a small child, and then the rest would try to match the adults to the childhood pictures. I got 1 or 2. Most of the social workers got 6 or 8 or more. We also played the game where a tray with assorted objects is shown and then quickly snatched away, and you are supposed to remember what was on it. Again, I had the low score. Finally, there was a game that tested oral comprehension, and once again, to my own surprise and mortification, I scored low. It struck me that these people must see a completely different world from mine. From the above data, you might expect my poetry to be somewhat solipsistic. Again, surprise. Much of my poetry is about relationships, especially with other poets. Many of my poems are written in other poets' voices, because the subject matter made me hear what they might have said about it. Despite my social ineptitude, I am a good listener. I don't remember names and faces very well, but I remember conversations. In a group, I am often the one person who can sum up what others have been saying and put it all together. Everyone has heard that story about the 7 blind men and the elephant. You know, One grasped the tail and said it was a rope. One grasped the leg and said it was a tree, etc. I would like to hole up somewhere with, say, a visual artist, a social worker, a mathematician, an engineer, an economist, a computer expert, and a business person, and brainstorm till we can see into each other's worlds, put our heads together. Perhaps in this way, humanity could grow a brain big enough to handle its problems. I'm Esther Cameron for Mind's Eye Radio.
While the output of our collective cerebrums cause progress of many types, the cost to the individual when the wiring goes weary is more than equal, in that person, to the GNP of all nations. So says Paul Thompson.
On the eastern shore of Lake Galilee, in the area known as the Golan Heights, are the ruins of an ancient Christian monastery. And a little ways away, a cave with a pillar of rock in front of it. This marks the place where early Christians believed Jesus healed the man infested with demons. At that time, illnesses of all sorts were believed to be caused by demons or God's punishment. Today, we would say this man had a mental illness. I am impressed not so much by the healing itself, but by Jesus' approach to this man. The madman was a pretty fearsome fellow, if we accept the gospel writers. The Incredible Hulk had nothing on him. He broke free of the strongest shackles, ran howling through the desolate places, and cut himself with sharp stones. He had not one, not two, but a whole legion of demons inside him. In short, he wasn't anyone we'd like to have as our neighbor. And Jesus, being completely human, must have felt some fear or nervousness in approaching him. In addition, among the Jews, and Jesus was a Jew, a mentally ill person was considered ritually unclean and was shunned by the community. And finally, the man was probably a Gentile, a non-Jew, since this was a region inhabited largely by Romans and Greeks. Hence the convenient herd of swine into which the demons fled, which were raised to feed the Gentiles and their soldiers. Gentiles were hated and despised by many Jews as unclean occupiers of Palestine. But none of this deterred Jesus. In spite of his fears and upbringing, he approached the insane man. Jesus saw him not as a monster, but as a human being deserving of respect and kindness. His actions, although the gospel writers don't put this in words, said, "You are my neighbor, and you are in trouble, and I will help you." And isn't this what Jesus and other teachers of Judaism tell us over and over again? The first and greatest commandment is this: love the Lord God with all your heart and mind and soul. And the second is like unto it: love your neighbor as yourself. The two commandments are linked. We love God by loving our neighbor. And Jesus makes it very plain that all humanity is our neighbor, especially those in need. When we reach out to them, we reach out to God. I was hungry and you gave me meat. I was thirsty and you gave me water. I was naked and you clothed me. And I had a mental illness, and you did not shun me, but treated me with loving kindness. You paid the taxes and passed the laws that enabled me to receive the care I needed to get well. You made a place in your community and in your congregation where I could heal and perform meaningful work. Mental illnesses are one of the great scourges of the globe. They affect rich and poor alike. A mental illness often strikes first in adolescence or early adulthood, just when life seems most promising, and unless properly treated, it can ruin an individual's chances for a happy, productive life. And sometimes it leads to jail, homelessness, or suicide. As a mental health volunteer, I can't tell you how many parents I've heard say, Joe or Jane was an outstanding student, talented, popular, ready for a wonderful career when the illness struck and everything changed. Major depression, the most common mental illness, costs our nation some $40 billion each year in lost productivity, not to mention the intangible costs of suffering for the individual and the family. If we are surprised by this figure, it is because the stigma of mental illness leads many individuals and families to conceal the illness even from close friends or relatives. For no other illness, with the exception of AIDS or perhaps addiction, carries such a burden of stigma. Individuals with a mental disorder are considered odd, even dangerous, and after 2,000 years, still are often shunned by the community. Frequently, they are blamed, or their parents are blamed, for their illness. It takes a brave person, someone like a Mike Wallace, a Tipper Gore, or a Ted Turner, to say publicly, I've struggled with a mental illness. And I wonder what would have happened in their careers if they had revealed this fact early on, instead of waiting until they were established and famous. We are only beginning to unravel the causes of mental illness, but we do know mental illness is not a punishment from God, ordinarily not the result of poor parenting, not something the person brings on himself. It is a chronic physical disease like heart disease or diabetes with significant changes in the wiring and chemistry of the brain, and it often can be treated and controlled as successfully as heart disease or diabetes, enabling the person to live a fuller and more productive life. When we consider the costs and suffering from mental illness, we have to say that our society is not coping well. Research funds are only a fraction of those being devoted to other illnesses. Our health insurance system is inadequate, and our public mental health system is underfunded with long waiting lists for nearly every service. As a result of these barriers, individuals with a mental illness often receive poor treatment or none. Most of us remember Mr. Rogers and his song, It's a beautiful day in this neighborhood. Won't you please, please won't you be my neighbor? As a Presbyterian minister, Fred Rogers certainly was aware of the deeper significance of the word neighbor. Let us today begin to say to those with mental illnesses and their families, it's a beautiful day in the neighborhood. Please, won't you be my neighbor? This is Paul Thompson for Mind's Eye Radio.
Our Dr. Stringlove warmed to the topic of de brain, but was chilled when it left him alone and without ego in a world seemingly without science or art.
Hello. Dr. Stringlove barely here. I have the Triple U Surgery Department to thank for being here at all. This recent traumatic experience got me thinking about the brain, which I usually dismiss as something mushy, which does its best to avoid work and spends too much time watching television. I don't want to get into the distinction between brain and mind. If you want details about that, any philosophy major at the University of Chicago will give you more than you desire. Let's just say the brain is host to the mind, either as a symbiont or parasite. I don't care which. I want to tell you about what happens when the brain runs off the track and you have a brain wreck. Naturally, major surgery is carried out with the patient under the influence of various narcotic and hypnotic drugs. So it is natural that I hallucinated during the next 2 days in intensive care. The least bizarre of these visions was that the world consisted of a crystalline lattice of thick, transparent plastic. Somehow, people were able to exist and move through the interstices. The other hallucinations I had cannot be described in words. The most frightening experience occurred after I was moved to the surgery ward to finish recovering. I awoke a little before sunrise and immediately realized I was looking through a sixth-floor hospital window at the beautiful Unitarian meeting house. There was a light on inside, which I thought strange, given the energy-conscious congregation. I had no trouble remembering all this. However, I suddenly realized I did not know who I was. The sense of identity that is our constant companion had deserted me. Since it seemed important to be someone, I decided to solve this problem using pure logic. The name I came up with didn't seem to be right, because I knew Ignat Stringlove to be a vigorous, healthy person, not a helpless patient in a hospital bed. Fortunately, by the time the physician on patrol came to check on me, my sense of identity had returned from wherever it had been lurking. Even this short brush with amnesia was disquieting enough for me to give my brain a stern lecture about keeping on track in the future. This is Dr. Stringlove, grateful to put the brain back to work for Mind's Eye Radio.
Words are powerful trumpeters of the power of the thinking apparatus, and poet Judith Zuckerman does her best to protect them in He Chose His Words.
He chose his words. We talked in a slow, relaxed way, the head of cardiothoracic surgery and I. No question was out of bounds. He answered in a thoughtful way. I already knew stroke and death a possibility, but even if the operation goes well, I asked, will my thinking be the same? Many don't notice a difference, but you probably will. I had a musician from New York Philharmonic, he said, who couldn't concentrate on a long piece in early months after surgery. On the fifth day in the hospital, I sat in a chair, held the pen in my hand for the first time over my journal. The words poured into my brain, but my hand could only shape one letter at a time. But my words never left me. This is Judith Zuckerman for Mind's Eye Radio.
We hope we haven't hurt your thinker too much, positing psychological puzzlers in prosody and poems. So come back home after the quick break, and we'll soothe the synapses with material geared to please. What's in the pantry of the brain pan? And lots more gray matter. Medulla oblongata, cerebellum, pons, corpus callosum. No, these are not Batman-style oaths, but rather the amazing machinery of the brain, which, while sturdy most of the time, can turn, according to the late Darla Barclay.
I think, therefore I am, René Descartes. Thinking requires a brain. So without thought, without a brain, does one exist? Well, there's not much one can do without a brain or brain function. Of course, there are those who would argue that life can be lived with a machine breathing for us and nourishment dripping into our veins via tubes and needles. We humans are still brainstorming this issue. The brain has so many functions and so many parts that make up the whole. Forebrain, midbrain, hindbrain, cerebral hemisphere, corpus callosum, thalamus, hypothalamus, medulla oblongata, cerebellum, pons, stem, and more. Not all these parts are easily identifiable by the human eye. In fact, the brain just looks like a gray lump of wadded-up neural tissue resting on a stem. How does it do all it does? Neurons firing and synapsing cause us to breathe, swallow, see, walk, talk, think, remember, and even fall in love. When those same neurons misfire, or synapses don't occur properly, or the brain is damaged in some way, we become very different from what we were before. Like my friend Jack. Picture him in your mind. Tall, handsome, intelligent, successful, confidant and mentor to Fortune 500 executives and boards of directors. He stumbled and fell 7 years ago. Simply fell mid-conversation while walking. Didn't hit his head, had no other symptoms nor pain prior to the fall. The doctors discovered upon examination that a minuscule, non-malignant tumor on his brainstem caused the problem. If left to grow, they said, it would over time disable him. So they operated, removed it, and that speeded up the debilitation. You see, the brainstem controls motor responses, those things our body does without us even thinking about them, like breathing and swallowing. Initially, after the operation, he was flat on his back with a machine breathing for him. He has worked hard to get better, and now, all these years later, they have just removed his trach tube. He is breathing on his own and striving to speak and be understood. He emailed last week to say he had just taken 10 steps using a cane, a huge triumph. Jack can't swallow yet. He hasn't tasted his favorite foods, or any food for that matter, since the surgery. Instead, he gets a goopy cocktail poured directly into his stomach through a tube. He really likes it when I talk to him about delectable edibles, as I tell him of rich chocolate cakes and chili rellenos full of messy melted cheese. He closes his eyes, smiles, and nods his head in great pleasure. These discourses on food trigger his memory, and it's almost, but not quite, as good as eating. Memories, good and bad, reside within the brain, and recent research shows travels on electrical impulses and chemicals throughout our bodies and set up residence within the cells. This is called cellular memory. And it has been noted that transplant patients sometimes take on personality traits or tastes of their donors. This amazing information reminds me of my favorite brain movie, Mel Brooks' Young Frankenstein, with Gene Wilder as Dr. Frankenstein, Peter Boyle as the monster, and Marty Feldman as Igor. After Dr. Frankenstein unearths a body from the local cemetery, Igor is dispatched to find it a new brain. He breaks into a lab with shelves full of jars containing pickled brains. Suffering from a bit of memory loss, Igor forgets the name of the particular brain he is to find and chooses the one labeled Abby Normal. The brain, instead of just recreating life when implanted, causes the body to become the monster, who runs away holding his head, tortured by the memories within. Basically, whether you're a brainiac or a harebrain, your brain is in charge. It continues to grow within itself and create new paths each time you learn something new. Here's something new I just learned. Teenagers drive the way they do because their brains are not yet fully developed. I read this in an Allstate insurance ad, so you know it's true. It explains a lot, and I will think more kindly of teenage drivers from now on. Ambrose Bierce said that the brain is an apparatus with which we think that we think. Noodle on that. This is Darla Barclay for Mind's Eye Radio. Thank you.
Sometimes twilight comes at the wrong time of day, according to Evie Thompson.
It's twilight, and Denise walks into the living room. She went to bed late and has been sleeping all day. She's just gotten up. She's wearing gray sweats and is carrying a cup of black coffee in her bony hand. Her hand shakes so much the coffee nearly spills on the carpet. Denise is 29 and has returned home to live with her mother for a while. She doesn't like being spoken to when she first wakes up, so Martha waits for her to speak first. Martha, seated at a card table, is working a jigsaw puzzle, 550 pieces. The picture on the top of the box shows a bridge over a stream, with a cottage behind it. She has the border in place. Behind her, the white wall next to the open window has turned orange-pink, which is strange, because the sun has already set. Martha rises to look outside and sees that the sun's rays, coming from below the horizon, are reflecting off the fat underbelly of a huge cumulus cloud overhead and casting an orange glow over the countryside. "Such a strange dream," Denise says. "I had such a strange dream." "Oh," Martha says, not venturing more. A visit with Denise's eating disorder therapist has taught Martha a lot. The therapist told her that the eating disorder leaves Denise with control issues, so Martha tries to be very careful in everything she says or does, even to not entering Denise's room when Denise has been in there so long that Martha's afraid she's died. Martha sits down stiffly and bends her head to the puzzle. With her square hands, she fits a piece to the border. She's a step closer to the part of the puzzle that has the cottage in it. Outside, the orange light is turning trees and fields beige and pink with no shadows. The air is heavy. Denise sits on the sofa with her legs twisted under her, her narrow shoulders rolled forward, her chest caved in. Her sweatpants form endless gathers at her thin waist. "I dreamt I was so hungry for meat that I took a big bite out of my shoulder, and it tasted good." Denise has not eaten for several days now. Martha knows this, because there have been no candy bar wrappers, no plastic microwave dinner trays, no half-drunk glasses of Coca-Cola around. "Are you hungry now?" her mother asks. "Yeah, but you know how it is. I'm hungry, but I just can't make myself eat." The therapist had said it will do no good to cook food for Denise, or even to offer it. "The thing is," the therapist said, "Denise has to find what she wants to live for. She can't live just because it would make you sad to lose her." Beyond the window, the color in the landscape has intensified, as if you were looking through a pair of orange sunglasses. Martha makes herself concentrate on the puzzle. She swallows hard, picks up a puzzle piece, and without thinking, slips it into place. Not forcing anything, that is one of the secrets of the puzzle. Sometimes a piece just slips right in. Then again, you can think you have the perfect piece for a spot, the right color, the right shape, but it just doesn't fit. You may have to add 6 other pieces before the time is right for that piece. "Patience," Martha thinks. "We will get to the cottage in due course." Out loud, she says, "I don't think I've ever seen light like this. It must be because we've had such a stormy day." "Yeah, I heard the thunder earlier. It was just enough to wake me up, but not keep me awake." The ground got quite a soaking. And so, talking quietly, Denise and Martha watch the strange twilight fade into darkness. This is Evie Thompson for Mind's Eye Radio.
Jim Nichols suffers us to listen along in his conversation among the three of him, he, himself, and his brain.
"Since I decided that I can't talk to myself anymore, it has become very lonely in my head. When I begin to speak to me, I must stop it with a stern interior look. This may be good. We don't have arguments anymore. No useless, repetitive, nagging advice. Yet, it is lonely. I think I am still out there, longing for conversation. But how will I ever know? This is Jim Nichols for Mind's Eye Radio.
Louise Mancuso finds some solace from the fading of a friend's brain in the sound of her own name.
The mind takes its time. Beta sits in her chair, staring. It's time for bed, but there is no ritual clicking off of TV, no rising from her chair to make her way to the bathroom, where she will floss her teeth and dress for bed. Something is wrong, but I'm not sure what. Are you okay, Beta? I ask. Silence answers me. I touch her arm. It may as well be wood. The minutes pass. The clock chimes. It's time for the bus to come and swallow me up. I wait for the turn of her head, for the light to return to diminished eyes. I will stay as long as it takes, and it takes more time for her tongue to loosen, gibberish escaping the lips that used to quote poets, that prodded and praised and blessed. I bless you now, Beta, as you struggle to your feet, rush to outrun this striking down, this stroke, this terrible sudden smite of your power. I make a call, agree to stay the night. No way I will leave you, Beta. No way I will chance your being taken. I wear a path between bedroom and parlor, hear each sigh, each tremulous crying out, "Where's that Italian girl?" I kiss your forehead. Listen as you tell me how your sister Emily, dead so many years, came to stand by your bed. You nod off, and I know there is no sleep for me, no time for me to close my eyes. Weary, I go out to the kitchen for coffee. Outside the window, a cardinal takes a meal in the growing light, her companion on guard in his brazen red. I take a sip of coffee, grateful for its warmth and goodness, like Beta is good, caring for her mother, then father, caring for her students who, after 50 years, return at reunion time to hold her hand and thank her, caring for this Italian girl, to whom she taught the finer points of gardening, to call wildflowers by name, and on our walks, talks about integrity, a lost virtue that must still be cherished. In the distance, a bird tweets. Pleased and feeling much more at ease, I turn back to the doorway and see Beta, looking frail, looking spent, with the glint again in her bluest of eyes. Louise, she says. Louise. This is Louise Mancuso for Mind's Eye Radio.
In the 60s, some of us worried that we would damage our brains if we kept taking that LSD. But now that we're older, we're not so concerned that we would damage our brains if we kept taking that LSD. But not now that we're older, we're not so damned. John Morgan wonders whether the cure for brain static is part of the cause in the following piece.
Brainstorm, brain drain, brain trust, brainwashing. Brainchild. My great-grandfather was born in Braintree, Massachusetts. Now there's a name for you. I have no idea where that name came from, but just imagine that if you got tired of your brain you have, you could just go out in the backyard, pick a new one off a tree, and have it transplanted. These days, they could probably do it with drive-through surgery. The frontiers of medicine are expanding at a dizzying pace. The brain is getting a lot of attention these days from people who are trying to help it and people who want to do it no good at all. Meditation is supposedly good for the brain. Folic acid is said by some to improve memory. One recent defender of meditation is Richard Davidson, a professor of psychiatry and psychology at the University of Wisconsin. He has done studies hooking people, including the Dalai Lama, up to electrodes while they meditate and discovered profound changes in their brainwave patterns. But a week after an article appeared about him in the weekly Isthmus, a reader, Nancy Jaba, wrote in to say that reports in psychiatric literature indicate that some people can be harmed by meditation, citing difficulties such as anxiety, dissociation, altered perceptions, and occasionally psychotic episodes. Oddly, these are some of the conditions that meditation is supposed to alleviate. But think about it. Is it not possible that these are pre-existing conditions, too severe for meditation to deal with? At any rate, it is possible that meditation is not for everyone. One influence that's not doing young people's brains any good these days is the Army. They're very concerned about all the brain-damaged men and women coming back from their wars. They're even testing their brains before they go to war, so they can monitor them for possible change when they return. Such solicitude is better than benign neglect or denial, but really doesn't get to the core of the problem. I submit that one of the biggest causes of brain damage these days is a Harvard education, or a Yale education. Many of the key people in the current and past administrations graduated from one of these hallowed institutions of reactionism. They bought the imperialist bill of goods, and it became a part of their intellectual armature, and has fatally corrupted their Weltanschauung, to the ongoing detriment of us all, and to our democracy. I don't know what the solution to this is. Only time will tell whether the wisdom of the people can overcome the ignorance of the masses. That's a dialectical conundrum that may be worth racking our brains over. This is John Morgan for Mind's Eye Radio.
Come be Greg Willard's guest for dinner at the Café of Brain, Le Café Perceval. Welcome to Le Café Perceval. My name is Balthasar, and I'm your waiter for this evening. Tonight's specials are poached and bronzed tuna brain, marinated in a basil and leek flambeau, fresh rhubarb and venison brain and barley hoof pie, our Calais hardtack, stuffed with ground snail and pineal gland, smothered in a barnacle swamp paste and wrapped in au gratin skin of seared amaranth yeast and Corinthian lard, throttled by dried beet and barley cat-of-nine-tail brainstem tenders, baked in banana leaf tongue of flayed Inquisition lobes in a scoop-skull gelatin mold atop a braised cerebellum roll stewed in a peach brandy cream udder, sauced and pleated in Ukrainian onion rinds on a bed of grated mango and tulip pestle garnish, with avocado skin bathed in pamplonin fig nectar and refined Oaxacan Tabasco ash, cask-aged on a Cajun suet brothel jam and limbic spread. We're also featuring fresh, free-range Utah cheetah placenta bisque of mangoed cerebellum broth, served on a chilled heirloom chick beak and claw consommé seasoned with a runt potato and collard cerebral hemorrhage sauce, with a side of hummingbird brain mash in palsied testicular drippings, and a decanted goat gland gelatin puree stuffed with fresh Brazilian torquemada bean and dried roasted El Prospero thistle root dipped in Colorado anteater musk of neuronal mesh gingered simples. For entrees this evening, we're offering beaten, honeyed badger frontal lobe, a roasted rump lobotomy stirrings in a tangy pheasant pox marinade, Kodiak skirt steak in a raisin and magma sauce, purloined pug hen pons steamed in a soured horse milk, and a spinach and peyote ox soup chowder, served with a side of freshly salted Algerian malt flakes crumbled over a blackened leg of clove brocaded cortex of Berber mutton. Would you like to start with a drink? So we've climbed into the cabin and run through the brain's gearbox, played music on the misty xylophone of interconnected webbing, and run our fingers over the smooth carapace that houses its most interesting of organs. We really hope you were hanging over the fence that divides us from you, and thank you for tuning to Me and My Noodle, or The Brain Train, by the Mind's Eye Radio Collective of Madison, Wisconsin. Today's contributors include Darla Barclay, Esther Cameron, Louise Mancuso, Jim Nichols, Ruth Nichols, Norma Gay Pruitt, Louis Rawl, Fran Rawl, Lynn Patrick Smith, Evie Thompson, Paul Thompson, Guy Thurvaldson, Greg Willard, Josephine Zell, and Judith Zuckerman. The show is produced by Kelly Warren and co-produced by Gay Davidson-Zilski. Original music by Barbara Chusin. To listen to this, our archives, and many other provocative programs, go to www.radioforall.net. That's number four. I'm Greg Willard. Till next time, best wishes from Mind's Eye Radio.